Over two centuries ago, it was England that taxed our tea. Now it's Brussels trying to regulate our companies. Under new European regulations, American businesses face crushing fines, forced disclosures, and foreign red tape that kills jobs here at home. America's laws should be written in America, not Brussels. Reject European regulatory overreach and uphold Trump's trade deal. Paid for by Americans for Limited Government.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Kiwi Talks. My guest today is currently an artist at Pixar who has worked on over 18-plus films. But before that, he worked in the video game industry on games such as Grim Fandango, the Star Wars Rogue Squadron games, Episode One Racer, just to name a few. I'd like to welcome Paul Topalos. How are you doing?
Doing well. Thanks, Reese, mate. Thank you.
Thanks for taking time out of your day. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
One of the things I want to know is, because you worked for both Lucasfilm and LucasArts, how different were those two, I guess, subsidiaries, I guess you could say? Yeah. Or was there a lot of overlap and similarities?
Well, I think part of it is, I mean, games, you're building kind of a world, a place that you can explore and go around. Whereas film, it was shot based. So a shot is a length of film unbroken by a cut. And so you would be breaking down a movie in terms of all the different locations, how much coverage. Whereas a game, you'd be thinking, I mean, it was a little bit more about world building, and it was, you know, especially in some of the flight games, the player could kind of fly just about everywhere that they wanted to go. And I think maybe the other difference would be just in terms of an emotional thing, that a film is all about emotion, conflict. I mean, I guess there's conflict in video games, but it's a little bit different. I think games tend to be a little bit more about mood and action, and film is definitely a lot more of a visual representation of a narrative, of storytelling. So I think too, when I was working at Lucasfilm, it was only about the visuals, and you didn't have the limitations of what a game engine could handle. So you didn't really have to worry about frame rate. I could paint paintings that would be pretty huge. Whereas in games, depending on the game, there was a lot more about limitations.
Mm. Did you have to transfer between both? So you'd have a frame of mind where you'd be developing games, and then you'd do stuff for Lucasfilm, well, and then you'd have to change your mentality somewhat.
Although, so I just worked briefly on Episode One as a storyboard artist, and so that
you weren't credited. You should have been credited.
I was uncredited. Yes, I didn't. Yeah, I didn't have enough clout to, and I didn't work. Definitely did not work long enough on it. They had a big story push, and so. One of the guys that I had apprenticed under, Ian McCaig, who there was a big story crunch. And so I got brought up with another artist, amazing artist, Peter Chan, who did a lot of work for LucasArts. So both he and I went up for this crazy storyboarding crunch. And then a few years later, I was doing more matte painting, but also model painting for the animatics crew on Episode Two. And so that was in some ways a little bit similar to the work that I was doing on Rogue Leader, because it was model painting and also matte painting, which is kind of like making a background. So in some ways there's there are similarities because you're dealing with Star Wars, you're dealing with that kind of Star Wars aesthetic. So it wasn't, it wasn't that much of a switch, and both were just very high pressure, long hours. So there was a lot in common as far as like just the workflow.
Yeah. But I do wonder though, is there a bit of a checklist for you, like in terms of what you can and can't do? Like how far can you push it before it's deemed not Star Wars enough in terms of artistry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what was kind of fun, like on Rogue Leader, was that Rogue Leader kind of, it art directed itself, it's like in that if there were things that sort of strayed away from Star Wars, you could tell, everybody could tell. I mean, it wasn't me coming down, talking to somebody as if, I had my own sense of it. It was like, hey, does this look like this? Or does this feel like it could belong in the same world? And, but that being said, it was, I remember, I think it was on Racer that it was the first time that they brought us up to Skywalker Ranch, to the secret third floor. And that was the first time that I saw all the concept art. And I almost teared up. It was just so amazing. Just all the work of Doug Chang, Ian McKaig, Jay Schuster, Terrell Whitlatch, the model makers, just looking at all this artwork that was, because I hadn't seen anything from the prequels. I mean, I knew Doug's style, but it was, I thought that's what kind of was refreshing, was that it was so different, and yet it kind of felt like Star Wars, it wasn't, it was definitely a lot more sort of aerodynamic and lots more sort of curvy shapes. It wasn't as sort of blocky as some of the Star Wars stuff tends to be, but some of the Episode One stuff was definitely a lot more ornate. They were looking at, for Theed, a lot of sort of Turkish architecture and Moorish architecture. So I think that was what was kind of refreshing, was just to see this stuff that was part of the prequels. It was stuff that George was approving, but it had a very different look than my generation of Star Wars. So I don't know if that long answer.
No, it kind of makes sense, but I'm trying to remember, because when did Episode One Racer get greenlit? Was it during the production of Episode One? I'm trying to recall.
So it came out with Episode One. So that right. was, that was our big hard deadline. And I
so
remember,
you were being exposed to the film, or you got to see part of the film or concept art, maybe shots of the film, prior to the release of Episode One. So you're working
with it. You kind of had to. And then when I was storyboarding, I was seeing a lot more of the film, obviously, because I'm doing the boards. But it was fascinating, because even Ben Burtt, the amazing, amazing sound designer, they were finishing Racer. They'd finished it. It was in the can. And then at the very last moment before Episode One released, they changed the sound effect for Sebulba's pod. So if you play the game Racer, that you'll notice it's a different sound effect. That's a little trivia for the nerds, me being one of them. It was fascinating, because I remember when they were working on Racer, they couldn't really have the pods for the longest time, because all this stuff was very top secret. So they would have two TIE fighters being as the engine. So that was when they were working on the programming, that's that was what they sort of substituted so that nobody would see the actual, what the actual racers were for a little while. And then, so it was a very, you know, the concept art, all that was very, very sort of secret for a long time during the process.
So what was it like for you then when you first watched The Phantom Menace? Considering that you would have seen the Podracer in its full glory, and then obviously you did some work on it as well. So was it surreal?
Yeah, I mean, I think as an adult, my experience was a little bit different than, I remember sometimes like working at the ranch and something would blow you away. Like I'd be working at the ranch and somebody needed just as reference the Jawa gun from New Hope. There's the Jawa gun right there on the table. And that would just blow me away. Or Sir Alec Guinness's robes, Obi-Wan robes, would be up there. And, you know, I would think about how I would be as a little kid. I would just be like, and you can see my hand, I'd just be like, oh, I'm taking that. I'm going to. But as an adult, you know, your tastes kind of change. And so for me, the thing that was blowing me away was the artistry and the craftsmanship. And, you know, I do think, I mean, the pod racing sequence was great. And the animatics crew did an amazing job for George. And George was really into racing. And so it was really neat to see that. It was a little weird because I would be seeing bits and pieces of stuff. I'd be seeing concept art. I'd be seeing just these beautiful things, and you weren't quite sure how they were all going to fit once you saw the movie. We'd seen a few rough cuts of the film, and so it was both amazing to see it all together. It was, you know, you also kind of saw how the sausage was made, and you're seeing all these things.
I suppose that dilutes the experience somewhat.
You kind of have a hypercritical view of stuff. And I remember early on, my buddy Ian, this was when I started boarding on it, he kind of told me what the story was. And so I almost like have that vision of episode one in my head of Ian McKaig telling me the story on the veranda of Skywalker Ranch. And, you know, so when he's telling me like, oh, Anakin was a slave, like, what? There's slavery on Tatooine? That's amazing. That's why Darth Vader's all messed up. And so you kind of have, I guess it's like people that read a book and then you see a movie and it might not be exactly what you thought it would be. Or,
yeah.
You know, and I think to say that I was a fan of the original trilogy, I think more the psychological term is fanatic. I mean, I was like, that movie changed my life and it made me interested in, you know, a lover of film, a lover of you know, classical music, of the works of Kurosawa and you know, all the John Ford movies and all that. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that I was kind of coming at it from a much different age and point of view. And I think maybe if I was taking LSD when I saw episode one, maybe it would bring me back to being a 10-year-old again. But it was...
Yeah, yeah. Well, I suppose it's different for people that actually worked on it, right? Because you know everything behind the scenes, you know all the hard work, as opposed to someone that's seeing a film or even playing a video game with no idea what went on behind the scenes. Sometimes ignorance is bliss, I guess.
Yeah. And I think, God, I was just listening to an interview with George where there's a wonderful interview, if anybody wants to watch, of Christopher Nolan interviewing George Lucas.
I've seen it.
I think it's Directors Guild. But you kind of get this sense of, sorry, I lost my leg, of that George didn't even know how good it was, or that he just saw all these faults with it. And even though, I mean, for me, the special effects as a little kid just were amazing. And it made me think, because I think last time we talked, I was telling you about one night, I can't remember if this was during the deleted scenes of episode two that I was working on, or if this was just on episode two. You know, I'm working at Skywalker Ranch, and one night they say, hey, if you want to watch 2001 with one of the original people from ILM, from Star Wars, when it was down in Los Angeles, he'll introduce 2001 for us, and we can watch it in George's private screening room, which, you know, sure, I'm going to watch that. And what he was saying about 2001 was that was their benchmark, and they wanted to make something as jaw-dropping as 2001, but fun. And that's, and when you see Star Wars, Star Wars was so much fun. It was, you know, part Western, part Buck Rogers, part Wizard of Oz, you know, with these groundbreaking special effects that nobody had ever seen like that in such an enjoyable way. I mean, 2001 is just so breathtakingly beautiful, but it's not really a kid's film.
No, it isn't.
And I've completely forgotten what your question was. I apologize.
That's all right. That's all right. I've even forgotten my own question because I was so entrenched in what you were saying. It's real fascinating. I wanted to ask you about Rogue Leader because I feel that's one of the best looking games on the GameCube. I think if you just up-res'd it, it would still look amazing. Right?
It's funny. I got a quote. It's from Orson Welles, and it says, "The enemy of art is the absence of limitations." A friend of mine used that at work recently, and I thought that was
a good quote.
That was a good quote because when I first started working on Racer, it was all about limitations. It was, you know, it was like that bit in Apollo 13 where they say, you have to make this fit with this only using this. And I think somewhere else they were talking about that the lunar module only had enough electricity to play with that would be like a coffee maker. And I think the analogy that I gave you was working on a Nintendo 64 game was like riding on a moped that was almost out of gas with a flat tire, and you've got blinders on, you know, and you've got severe diarrhea. I mean, it's like everything. I couldn't believe it because you're dealing with a postage stamp texture.
Yeah.
And that would be 64 pixels by 64. And it wasn't even that. It was 63 pixels by 63 pixels. And you had to copy a row, put it over on the other side. These would be for tileable textures. And then you had to reduce it down to 16 colors using a program called the Babelizer. And then, so each level, you would have maybe 29, maybe 32 textures for the background. And just like that quote about limitations, that was kind of freeing for me because there've been open-ended games that I worked on that were just kind of, you just couldn't get your head around. But this one, it's like you get the 29 textures, you find photographic reference, you iterate, you try maybe 50 different things until you find the best one. And it's like and you work off that. And so in my head, it's like, okay, 29 textures. I can do that. 29. Okay, 28 now. I just got this perfect one. All right, 27. And so that's kind of this mentality that I had these textures were precious, and that you were trying to get use every part of the buffalo to get a level that looked good. And on Rogue Leader, all of a sudden, the moped's gone. Here are keys for a sports car. Here's a Ferrari. You don't have to worry about that. You're dealing with this. And so I think a lot of us at Factor Five had been so burned and had so many frustrations on Rogue Squadron that we still had this idea of limitations that was good on Rogue Leader. And it's like a programmer would tell us how many polygons, what was our limit, and it was so much more than we had on Rogue Squadron. But we try to be frugal. And so my thing was that, okay, I've got this huge, you know, when Julian, the head of Factor Five, was pitching this to me, he was like, you can do 1024 by 1024. And most TVs were, what, it was like 480, I think.
Yeah.
So I had this huge palette to work with, and I could have any color that I wanted. And for me, I wanted this game, now that I had the biggest palette, I wanted it to be ILM quality paintings on the models. I wanted it to blow people away. I wanted it to be the highest quality that you could do. And I was going to use every freaking pixel of that 1024. And I think before that, just because of frame rate and stuff, people were having to paint very small. Even like an amazing game like Dark Forces and Jedi Knight, Chris Hockabout was still painting these. And there was, for how beautiful they looked, there was also kind of like a stylization to them. And this, I kind of wanted to go the opposite extreme, that now that we could do special effects quality paintings on the model, I was going to do that. And so I was telling you that, you know, all of us that worked on the game were huge Star Wars fans. And I think we just wanted to do it right. We wanted to do it right for our memories, for me to kind of like thank, you know, not George necessarily, but thank the movie, thank all the artists that worked on it, and, you know, all this inspiring artwork. Because as I'm doing all the paintings for the models, I'm looking at the original models, and I'm using, you know, bits and pieces of those, and I'm painting on top and trying to get these things to look as authentic as I could. And just my respect for the model makers and the craftsmen and the designers, that was what was kind of, I guess, my North Star. And that was the thing that kind of got me really motivated, was just seeing all this beautiful work that was such an important part of my childhood. And I think even as a little kid, I was kind of disappointed with, like, what was it, some of the Kenner toys and stuff that would come out. I remember when the action figures, I was like 10 years old when Star Wars came out. I was like, oh my God, there's action figures, and they come out and they're really kind of crappy. And this is not on model. 10-year-old is judging corporate toys as not being very good. And so it would kind of annoy me when I would see Star Wars things that didn't live up to, you know, the quality of the movies. And I think that one of the things that I tried to push when I was at games was that the visual side is very important. Everything that you see on the screen is geometry and digital paint. And that even though it's a game and that it has to be fun, everything that you see is created, and there's a responsibility to make, especially when you're working on a movie title, there's a responsibility to make that stuff look as good as it can. And my argument to upper management was, it's actually beneficial to the bottom line. The more you can make a game look better, the more that you can make it look closer to the movie, the more people that are going to buy it, the more people like me that's not a gamer. But if I saw something that was amazing looking, that would intrigue me. And I think that was what was like when Chris Klei, who's an amazing level designer, he and I worked really hard on the Space World demo and worked hard on getting Rogue Leader with a whole team. He and I just were like, we're gonna try and blow these people away as far as, you know, the visuals, because the programming guys in the GameCube itself were just so massively strong. It was just so important to us just to try and make this groundbreaking visuals, because Star Wars was groundbreaking. So it was like we had a high bar to follow.
But you did it right out the gate, because it was a launch title for the GameCube, right?
Yeah.
So you delivered one of the best looking games on the GameCube right out the gate. Like, usually with hardware, it takes developers a while to work out everything before, and then usually by the end of the generation, people tap into the hardware more. But you guys, just right out the gate, you delivered one of the best looking games. I think that's still amazing to this day.
Thanks. Well, yeah, I mean, it was a total team effort. And I think the thing I was telling you before was that for how great LucasArts was, sometimes they were a little bit short-staffed programming-wise. And I think the good thing about Factor 5 was that it was programmer heavy, and it was a very small art department. And I think for me, Rogue Squadron, I think the word dumpster fire kind of maybe overused, but it was a hard game. Rogue Squadron was very difficult to get through. And pretty much right after Rogue Squadron, we did Rogue Leader, and we had learned the hard way so much from Rogue Squadron. And so we didn't want to get burned again. So it was like we were able to hit the ground rolling. No, what I'm trying
hit
to
hit the ground running. The right, there you go.
Hit the ground running. Yeah, you don't want to be rolling. You don't.
No, you wouldn't want to be rolling. No.
But it was again this idea of limitations, of like, we knew, okay, we can use so much, we have so many more polygons, we've got so much more space for textures, but you know, you got to keep the frame rate. And we knew off the bat that we had to limit ourselves. Like, even though it looks great, it is there's a limited number of textures, a limited number of polygons, but we tried to squeeze everything that we could out of that. So I think, you know, I think on the good side, it was the right conglomeration of the right people at the right time. And I guess none of us had social lives back then. I mean, it was, I think I told you, it was like the opposite of Das Boot, where at the end of 9 months, we were all pale but pudgy from all the rich bad food that we would be eating comfort food just about every night in the office.
And so you were crunching a lot, I take it.
We were crunching for 9 months. I mean, for the whole
really?
For the
so
whole time.
How many hours? How many hours are we talking a week?
Well, so I was telling you that the weird thing was that I agreed to do Rogue Leader. And so the only two LucasArts people that were brought over were Chris Klei and myself. And I agreed to join. And then all of a sudden I get a call from Lucasfilm saying that they want me back for episode 2, which was just such an honor. And it was also like, the parent company is asking for this. So, you know, I think I told you that it was like asking my mom and dad for permission to do something. It was like, I had to ask Factor 5. I had to ask LucasArts, but both of them knew that the parent company was asking for this. And so their thing was, well, you know, we'll give you permission to work yourself to death. But if you can't fulfill your obligations to Rogue Leader, then we'll have to, you know, tell the parent, you know, we'll have to tell Lucasfilm that you can't do it. Right. So it was during that time, it was two full-time jobs for me. It was going into maybe Factor 5 at about 9:30 till about 2:30, and then driving up about 20 minutes to Skywalker Ranch for like 2:30 until 11, midnight, 1. And then I would flip it the next day. I would do Lucasfilm in the morning and then Factor 5 in the evening.
Was that 7 days a week?
Factor 5 guys. Yeah, 7 days a week. I think I had one.
Oh, my God. And how long was that for?
It was a good 9 months, 9-10 months. It was, yeah. But it was, it was kind of, I saw it as like my graduate school, you know? And I saw it as my ticket kind of, I mean, it was the first time I was asked to be a lead artist, which is sort of the game industry that's equivalent to a production designer. So
right.
It was a promotion for me, but it was also the longest that I had ever worked on a motion picture. And you know, Episode 2 was a big, big movie. And so I was kind of seeing the stars aligning and being like, okay, this could actually give me, you know, my golden ticket to work more in film, which was what I was wanting, or it could kind of help cement my place in games. And I think the thing that I loved about Rogue Leader was that it was like, what I said was like, look, I'm going to do all the ships, I'm going to do all the landscape stuff, I'll take on the worst job, I'll take on the hardest job, you want special effects, I can, yeah, I'll give you laser textures and all this stuff. And I didn't mind that because it was just such a small team. I mean, there was just, you know, there was me and Jim Moore, there was amazing modeler Bastian Hoppe, and Mario. Bastian did all the cockpits, all the ships, all the rebel ships. Mario Wagner did the TIE fighters. And it was a very small group. And we just, for me, it was kind of, you know, for how difficult Rogue Squadron was, Rogue Leader was, it was, even though the workload was so much bigger and it was more complex, I could just go into work, put headphones on, listen to documentaries about World War One or whatever, and just geek out on painting spaceships all day.
But how do you maintain how do you maintain that for that duration of time, though? Because you're going back and well, yeah. Well, I
it was
imagine
a German
so.
Company.
I know, but if you're going back and forth between two companies 7 days a week for 9 months, I'm just wondering how you maintain the energy. And still sort of stay focused, because wouldn't eventually you'd get tired and drained? And I would think it would be hard to maintain such a high level of work for that period of time. I mean, obviously you have a superpower.
It's not a smart. I don't even think it's a legal way to work either, but.
Well, it worked in your favor because you're in a good position now, but.
Yeah, but so, I mean, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, I think now a lot of us talk about work-life.
Balance, yeah.
But it was strange because I was getting to go to Skywalker Ranch every day. Every day I was able to, you know, they give you a special key. You go into the main lobby of Skywalker Ranch and you put the key in the door, which because the floors only go up to the second floor, and have this magic key that takes you up to the third floor. And so, I mean, there was something magical about sort of achieving your dream of being able to be there. I mean, like I was saying, just me being able to get my head down at Factor 5 and be painting X-wings and Y-wings and there was something meditatively wonderful about that. So it's like my memories of that time are not bad. It's actually,
well, yeah, if you enjoy what you do, then I guess it's great.
Yeah, I mean, I think if I'd been, you know, I mean, it was kind of, it would wear you down, but we were all, you know, it's like that bit in Full Metal Jacket where the editor for Stars and Stripes is saying, you know, it's a shit sandwich and we're all going to have to take a bite. It's like all of us knew that we were in this, especially, I mean, Rogue Leader had to come out on that date. It had to be a release title. And usually, and with movies, 99% of the time, they, well, maybe not 99, 87% of the time, they come out when they're supposed to. So it's like all the teams, both the Animatics team at Lucasfilm and Rogue Leader, we were all in the same trench. No, I don't think I should use war analogies, but it made
a lot
it
of, a lot of game developers
easier.
Do use war analogies when they yeah, particularly when they talk about crunch, so it's fine.
Yeah,
I think.
But nobody died.
No, nobody died. That is true.
But it's a different way of looking at things. I mean, the guy that I studied under, Ian McKaig, when I was first kind of like working for him and being his assistant and his apprentice, and I'd pick him up in the morning, because back then he didn't drive, and he'd be like, "Yes, Paul, I was up working till 4 a.m, and I feel excited. It's great." And you know, being around people like that was inspiring. There were all these stories of the art department at Skywalker Ranch just doing crazy hours, and animatics too, and just there was this camaraderie of trying to get all this stuff done, and it was sort of infectious. And I remember there was a kid that was working on episode 2, a guy named Dorian Bustamante, who's, you know, 20 years later now, he's like layout supervisor. He was worked on so many of the Marvel movies, and now he's at Disney. He was telling me that even now he's given a deadline, like, "Oh, you got to have the shot done by Thursday," and it's Monday. And he wouldn't be thinking Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. He would be thinking, "All right, there's 24 hours in a day times Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday." So he'd just be thinking in a totally different way than.
All right.
Yeah. And so when you kind of have that fire in your belly, you know, I think that's what's great about being able to work in such a fun industry, even though it can be high stress, is that there's kind of an excitement. You get a buzz of doing this stuff that, you know, millions of people might see. And there's also this stress of not wanting to mess up so
is there like imposter syndrome almost with
imposter
it?
Definitely. Definitely, but to a point. I mean, I think there are things that I know that I'm not so great at, and I'm afraid of being sniffed out. There are other
you
things.
You can tell me off air. You can tell me off air what that is.
No, but well, my second day storyboarding, it wasn't really a panic attack, but I went up to Ian and just said, I'm in way over my head. I don't think I can't do this, Ian. And here it was, this was, you know, the first movie that I'd was working on. It was episode 1. It was what I wanted to do since I was 10. And I was kind of freaking out. And Ian calmed me down and he was just like, "Don't worry, Paul. Let me just do your blue boards," which would be like really rough sketches. "And then you just draw these and make them beautiful." And that calmed me down. And it was like next day I got better and next day I got better. But it was, that was definitely imposter syndrome of, you know, walking in, you know, Doug Chang is just like this amazing. Well, I mean, they were all amazing. Doug, Jay, Ian, Terrell. I think my super, you know, if we all have superpowers, my superpower is not really something enviable. It's just that I can, I know that I can quickly in Photoshop make something look real-ish. So that's not the sexiest superpower. There's not going to be a comic book made out of me. You're not going to see me in a Marvel
movie.
Too
humble
with my stylus and my tablet. Say hi. I'll make that look real for you.
Yeah.
Paul's come to save us. But it's like with that stuff, I knew because I had done it so many thousands of times. You know, under pressure, I knew I could do that. And so even I was telling you that, you know, I did a lot of work on Lightyear, Pixar's Lightyear, and that aesthetic was a similar aesthetic. And they were like, God, you're fast, Paul. And I was like,
you learned it way back then, right?
Yeah.
How did you find, because obviously 9/11 kind of intertwined with the end of production on Rogue Leader, right?
Yeah.
And there was perhaps worry that the game was going to get canceled or you'd have to take stuff out?
Well, I mean, in my mind, in my head, I mean, I think I kind of knew the game would come out. But in my mind when that happened, because I remember we finished the game, but we were all supposed to come in every day in case something broke, because quality assurance people would be testing the game. And if something happened, or I mean, if something was broken, we would all have to be there. But I kind of came in late in the morning, and I just remember Mario Wagner came up to me and, can I swear on this podcast?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, sure.
Okay. Yeah. So Mario was like, there was a big fuck up. And I was like, did the server go down? And he's like, no, these planes. Why am I making Mario sound Hispanic? He was like, you know, telling me two planes hit the World Trade Center. And I was like, no, Mario, you didn't know that didn't happen. And yeah, and just to look at the news, and it really was, it made you think about, you know, what's important in life, and just all these thousands of people died, innocent people, and you're just like, you know, we're making a game. Is this, you know, is anybody gonna play games anymore?
I suppose energy is depleted at that point and nothing else matters.
Yeah, it was just such a strange thing. And I remember even my dad, you know, is not a very, you know, jingoistic guy, but I remember he bought me a flag to put on my in front of my house, you know, just because he was, it was a little strange. I was telling you, just Factor Five had a lot of people from, we had people, you know, obviously from Germany and New Zealand and France and Scotland and Canada. And I think they were a little bit weirded out, all the American flags on people's houses. But it was just a strange time. And I remember Humvees at the Golden Gate Bridge. And it, there's a great podcast about the making of Band of Brothers, if anybody is into that show. But I forgot Band of Brothers came out around the same time as, you know, I think it was like they had shown one episode and then September 11th happened, and they were kind of having a similar thing of just, who cares about a series when something like this happens? And I mean, it even made me think of, there's a Woody Allen film called Radio Days where Mia Farrow's character gets this big break, her first big break on the radio, and she's just about to say her first word when this guy breaks in and says, there's been an attack on Pearl Harbor. And she's like, what's going on? Who is this Pearl Harbor? And it was just a very confusing time. I think I was telling you about one of the guys in QA, one of the game testers, thought that it was in bad taste that in one of the missions you're killing TIE fighter pilots before they reach their TIE fighters, and it's like I could kind of see it, but TIE fighter pilots, they're bad. They're bad people. They're going to
They're
do
bad
bad
people, so
things.
they gotta go. Yeah.
They got to go, and they're clones anyway. They're
Yeah.
all
They're not real.
Jango Fett. I mean, it's
Abominations to God. There you go.
yeah,
But
but it's
did people who worked in America from other countries, whether it was France or New Zealand or Switzerland or wherever, did they understand the gravity of 9/11 at that point in time, or were
They
they just
did,
kind of
but
like, I don't quite understand how
yeah. I mean, I think
important
they
this is?
did, but also, I mean, you think about European history, even British history. I mean, I remember talking to Julian one time, and he was, God, now I can't remember the name. There was kind of like a German almost version of the IRA, or it was the. It's mentioned in the film Munich, but there were some terrorist things going on in Germany. The Front Bomb? God, I don't know the group, but I mean, it's. I think it was definitely strange for them. And Kershaw, Karatesh, lovely guy, and we were kind of protective of him because even though he's not Arabic, he's Turkish, but he looked a little. He didn't look like Joe American six pack, and I mean he was fine. But you were hearing about people that were Sikh that were getting beaten up because, just some
Yeah.
stupid. So I think, and I think even for some of the guys from Germany, just seeing the American flags was kind of a, just obviously having flags in front of houses didn't really work out so well in Germany a long time ago.
Yeah,
So,
but Americans are patriotic though. So you do see the American flag quite a bit.
oh yeah,
I did see
no.
there was I'm not sure if you saw this, but on TikTok recently there was some Australian girl that was in America and she saw a whole bunch of flags somewhere in Texas, and she said, "I'm tired of seeing American flags," and I think she got cancelled, or she got a whole lot of hate for what
Yeah.
was deemed mocking the American flag. But it's just,
Yeah.
yeah, but
Although
it's part of the culture, so.
Switzerland, I was amazed. Those Swiss have got a lot of flags up.
Do they?
They do. They do.
Interesting. Yeah.
No, but I it's yeah, it was kind of a crazy time. I mean, I grew up in a small town up north, and I remember right after 9/11, there was a young man from Petaluma who was in the Air Force, and they were doing patrols, and he kind of buzzed his hometown and got everybody scared. So, I mean, you were hearing about people in Kansas wanting to have wanting to protect their federal buildings against possible, terrorism. So it was just. It was a crazy time.
But the game came out, was a success,
Yeah.
regardless.
Sorry, we were, yeah, we went off on a tangent.
That
Yeah, the
that's all
game.
right. I love tangents, so it's fine.
Yeah.
I did want to cover Grim Fandango briefly, because that is the game that led you to your job at Pixar, right?
Well,
In a
and
way.
that game saved me twice. So, when I first started working at LucasArts, it was a storyboard artist, and things would go well, and they'd be like, "Hey, Paul, we love you. We'll call you again as soon as there's more storyboarding work." Thank you. So I would be let go. I would just be a contract worker, and I remember talking to my boss, just saying, "Hey, I'd really like to work here more." What can I do? What can I? And my boss said, well, LucasArts is not a charity, Paul. And we kind of get this sense that you're afraid of computers. And well, one, I wasn't literally afraid of computers. And my dad bought an Apple II in 1978. There were some rudimentary painting programs. And I also knew that LucasArts wasn't a charity, but I could see what they meant, because I think, you know, it's weird. I think in business, you have a perception of yourself, and then there's the perception that other people have of you. And so I think they'd only just seen me drawing paper and drawing people and spaceships and stuff. So they never saw that. And it just happened to be the luckiest of coincidences that Grim Fandango was looking for a texture artist. And for our listener, Grim Fandango was just a wonderful adventure game with all these pre-rendered images. It was a film noir game with De Los De La Muertos characters and all Hispanic actors and just wonderful music. And it was just, I love film noir, and I love anything that it has to do with that time period. I love, you know, Art Deco design, and so it was just the perfect entry level drug to Photoshop and to just working on these really cool designs. Peter Chan had done some beautiful artwork, and so that kind of cemented where I. People began to see, like, oh, hey, he can actually do this, and oh, that's actually good. And it kind of did a few things for me, because I realized I could actually paint stuff that wasn't there in the geometry and make it look like it was there in geometry, which is the tricks of matte painting. And it made me learn about bump maps and displacement maps. But when a friend of mine, a guy named Adam Schnitzer, had quit, he was doing 3D models. I was doing paintings for him. When he quit, I took his job so I started doing modeling and lighting. And so Grim Fandango really kind of gave me the digital chops. And it was another one of those games where I was doing crazy hours just because I was learning a lot. I mean, learning 3D is, especially for somebody like me, that was very difficult. But it was this idea that painting could save me, painting that I could paint stuff and paint displacement and all these things that would help fake geometry was a big thing that saved me. And then cut to years later, when I was applying at Pixar, I had to go to Pixar like three different times, be interviewed by 18 people. The technical lead, man named Rick Sayer, who can be a little bit intimidating looking and very serious. He's kind of looking at my portfolio and kind of frowning. And he was like, I don't see anything that's stylized in here. And then I thought, well, I guess it was the imposter syndrome. I was like, oh, you caught me. I guess I'm out. I thought I was pretty close, but I guess I'm going to go. And then this part of me was like, Grim Fandango. I worked on Grim Fandango, and I've got stylized stuff. And here, take a look. And his face changed. And this art director, Scott Capel, was like, what? Is that like The Sims? What was Grim Fandango? Is that like The Sims? And Rick Sayer was like, no, it was just the best game ever made. And so Grim Fandango saved me. So thank you, Tim.
The rest is history.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that, and I think to me, LucasArts, my time there and at Lucasfilm just really, it was kind of the finishing school that I always needed. And that was, like I was saying before, even though that was so much work, that was kind of what helped get me into Pixar, which was kind of what I had always been wanting to do. Was, you know, I remember having this big debate with some of my friends at Lucasfilm. I was like, well, would you rather work on, would you rather have lots of responsibility on a bad movie, or would you be okay with, you know, it's almost like a lesser role, but on a film that would be a classic that people would remember and that you could feel proud of? And it was interesting because some of my friends were like, nope, I'd rather work on a shitty film and have a lot of responsibility and be able to say, yeah, on this shitty film, that's my shot. That's, I did all that stuff for this shitty film. And for me, I was beginning to, I think I was beginning to get a little worn down in the industry just from the sense of, I was like, in video games, I was making beautiful stuff for people to blow up, or I was, you know, maybe working on doing film work for films that I didn't feel totally confident about. But it was like when I first started working at Pixar, you know, I remember seeing the reels for The Incredibles and just getting blown away and just thought, wow, this is a really good film.
And now you're making them.
Yeah, no, so it was, yeah, so that's my long-winded story.
I think that's a good place to wrap up. Before you go, though, because I think that's a brilliant arc, right, from there to now. But before you go, I will quickly ask about, because you interacted with George Lucas very briefly, right? What are the unspoken rules with George Lucas?
Well, it's, and I don't even know if George knew this, but we were just, I mean, it's kind of an unspoken thing. And even like at Pixar, it's the thing is, you know, be cool, don't geek out, don't. But I think with George, it was like, you know, he was the head of all these different divisions. He's trying to concentrate on his movie. You know, don't come up to him and, you know, start asking him questions. Don't, I mean, they were also saying don't say no to him, which wasn't like any of us would be like, well, nope. So it was, but it was a little strange because I remember on my first day, Ian had already told me kind of like the unwritten rules. And then I remember on my first day, Doug Chang was saying, did somebody tell you how to be around? You know, because I think George is kind of shy, and, you know, he's not really comfortable people coming up wanting to shake his hand, or, you know, there was some guy that did that, some guy that was, that had just started at ILM and went up to Jordan and was like, you know, you're the reason I'm in this industry. I just want to thank you. I'm going to work so hard for you. Da, 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 da. And they kind of sent out an email just saying, just chill out.
Keep your distance. Be chill. Yeah.
Yeah. And
well, I don't think people like it when you geek out over them. I think they find it very uncomfortable.
Yeah. I think, it, you know,
it's not normal. Depends. It's not.
Well, really... but I mean, it's like people get passionate about stuff.
Oh,
I mean,
of course they do. And it's very, you know, easy.
If I were to, oh yeah. I mean, if I were to see Steven Spielberg, I would politely geek out and ask him questions about Empire of the Sun, and, you know, just,
yeah, yeah.
You can't help, because I mean, so many of these things are part of your childhood, and, you know, I think it's again, it's sort of strange when you see how the sausage is made, that it's a different, you know, that it is a little bit different. And I think, you know, we would see famous people like at Skywalker Ranch, and it was just strange that I would see them, but my first I mean, I'm a shy guy, so I wouldn't come up to them
Really?
anyway.
You don't seem shy to me.
No, but I can't remember if I told you, but it was like I was they have like this rec center thing at Skywalker Ranch, and me and the animatics guys were getting lunch, and I see Paul Thomas Anderson, the film director. And I'm like, oh, there's Paul Thomas Anderson. And I kind of got eye contact with him just for a second. And he looked at me and he was like, he's like, yep, you spotted me. Now what are you going to do? Are you going to come and talk to me? And all of a sudden I'm just like, I'm just going back to my lunch.
Cool. Well, hey, I'll wrap up there. I could speak to you for hours, but time is of the essence. But if anyone wants to keep up to date with you and what you're doing, is there any way they can do that?
Not
You don't
really.
strike me, you don't strike me as a social media guy. I could be
No,
wrong.
I don't tweet or what do you do now on Elon Musk's X? Do you X? Do you?
I don't
But
know,
yeah,
actually. I mean, I still call it tweeting. I still call it Twitter. Maybe he'll call it Twitter X. I don't know.
no, I'm afraid I'm pretty horrible, and I got two really little kids, so it's like I think my conversational skills are not what they used to be anyway. So it's like
Oh,
I
I think
just
you underestimate yourself. You're doing pretty well. You're great. You're a natural at this. But yeah, okay. Well, that's fine. That's fine. If people want to contact you, they'll have to go through me. That's fine. I can be like your bodyguard or security guard.
My gatekeeper,
Yeah, a gatekeeper. That's a good way of putting it. All right. Well, that is the show, everyone. Make sure you share, like, and subscribe. And until next time, stay safe.